From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, our agriculture series, Full Plate, continues by taking a trip into the forest with some Wisconsin foragers.
Then Milwaukee Pride Fest prepares to celebrate 30 years this weekend. We'll look back at its history and what's in store this year.
We'll speak with pop artist Peter Max and the gallery owner that's bringing him to Whitefish Bay this weekend.
I am attracted to fun, hip artwork. And I love texture and bright colors and everything what Peter Max does are really pieces that I like.
And Bubbler Talk features a simple Milwaukee pleasure, frozen custard, both eating it and watching it come right out of the machine.
People, when they come in here and they see the machines running, it's total fascination and yeah, it's a great, great product when it's fresh.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. This summer, Lake Effect is exploring what agriculture means in southeastern Wisconsin in a series that we're calling Full Plate. Earlier this week, we got an overview of the area's agricultural past and present. Today, we meet someone outstanding in his field.
Actually, it is someone else's field. Foraging is the oldest form of procuring food. Lake Effect Susan Bentz brings us the story of someone for whom foraging is both a passion and a business.
Growing up in Racine, Wisconsin, Mike Joswick learned to forage with his dad, Larry, and loved it. Meet up with an occasional tick, no biggie.
You want to spray yourself? We have two different types. This is really powerful, so is this one. Just don't put anything on your skin directly.
So leading a gaggle of newbies on an expedition 100 miles west of Milwaukee is as natural to Joswick as breathing. We're on land owned by an amiable dairy farmer Joswick befriended near Cross Plains, Wisconsin. Joswick is allowed to comb the wooded parcels that intersperse the farmer's fields. In return, the farmer receives a couple of kringles, a bakery specialty of Joswick's hometown.
We'll be picking basically a bunch of different stuff today. Morels should be pretty good out there right now. This is probably the best chunk of the woods. We'll probably go to a couple other smaller parcels of the woods to kind of comb through here.
He distributes netted bags to his 9 apprentices. Most work at the Milwaukee's Pabst Theater Group and its hospitality team. They're on a group outing this day. Joswick says morels should be waiting for them beneath the trees, very specific trees, elms that have recently died. The group dutifully fans out, picks up long sticks, and begins sweeping away tall grasses, hoping to unearth the coveted mushroom.
The ground looks perfect in terms of moisture content. You should be seeing mostly blondes in terms of morels. And basically, just grab a stick, start sweeping the ground and working your way up the hill. Whoever's going to be closest to that tree, look pretty close to the tree and start working out away from the tree.
Chef Kevin Sloan cooks up meals for the array of artists and bands that perform at the Pabst and Riverside theaters. Sloan says he's been buying foraged and other fresh ingredients from Mike Joswick for years. He remembers the first time Joswick made a delivery in a totally different environment.
He showed up in the back alley and was talking to security. And you know, there's the walkie-talkies going all through everybody's wearing, and
yeah.
Somebody's like, somebody's here for Kevin, they have some mushrooms. And obviously, everybody on the tour is like, what? What kind of mushrooms?
Sloan loves being out in this environment. It's his second annual excursion with Joswick.
Morels are one of the toughest ones. If you learn on morels, you learn good, because it's a thing of patience. It's not about filling the bag all the time. It's more so just about getting outside.
Yeah, I think the same thing happened to me last year, though, where, like, towards the tail end, your eye really gets trained on what tree to look at.
Yeah, yeah.
And looking at the top.
And that's why you see me always doing this block in the sun to try to catch the glint of white off the tops of the trees.
Right.
And I'm looking half the time up rather than down.
While Chef Mark Sloan's team happily returns to Milwaukee with boxes brimming with morels, forager Mike Joswick returns to another big chunk of his business in an old warehouse in Walker's Point. He set up a state-of-the-art mushroom cultivation operation here. Temperature, air, and light are highly controlled, not to mention sanitation.
So this is kind of our production lab. These are perfectly 100% medical sterilized, and then we take them.
go through an insane amount of isopropyl alcohol, just cleaning all the surfaces, any tools that are going to touch the bags, and then we line up. My dad mixes, and then I inoculate.
Joswick's dad, you heard about earlier, was a middle school chemistry teacher in his first life, and he's critical to this mushroom operation. They're growing 18 varieties and about to experiment with more. Joswick shows me a huge specimen, white and exotic looking.
These ones are our hottest seller. Those are lion's mane mushrooms. They taste like seafood.
Van Lu is a more recent addition to the team. He's in charge of microgreens.
So we got 10 varieties of microgreens, mustard, kale, cilantro.
Lu is a chef and says teaming up with Mike Joswick was a logical next step in his evolution.
Eventually down the road, when Mike gives me a day off, I'll start doing private dinners, but that's, you know, just to kind of get keep my creative
juices flowing.
Yeah. And then eventually we'll expand further once we get another room with new products. It should be fun.
Joswick spends part of nearly every day making deliveries to restaurants from what they grow and gather themselves and procure from other foragers.
Now, what are these little guys?
Those are spruce tips.
Oh, my gosh.
So those are great. They got a good citrus bite. It all depends on the type of tree as well.
And what are the greens?
These are our pea tendrils from inside, our verdant pea tendrils. Chive flowers. These are our onion garlic chives that we grow. These are very, very popular. But yeah, and then we got some beautiful wild fennel. This one is from Southern Oregon, the wild fennel is.
So any of your own mushrooms?
Yep, all of our oysters. We got oysters, shiitakes, king trumpets, a whole mess of our other microgreens.
Joswick has 100 regular customers. If they're further away than Madison, Joswick dropships orders, and chefs find their chilled delivery on their doorsteps the next day. Local morel season has ended, so Joswick stocked up on specialty morels.
Chefs like the consistency of the Pacific Northwest morel more than local morels. So that's why I really focused a lot of attention 5 years ago in finding pickers out west.
So the size of those that you delivered would be what, 2 inches?
Around 2 inches. Those are Konica morels or burn morels that grow in forest fire zones out west.
David Magnasco owns Chef's Table in Walker's Point. He's one of the chefs who loves the imported morels, but he oohs and ahs equally over every bit of his order.
These are gorgeous, Mike.
So what will you be, what are some of the wonders you'll be cooking up?
So we're gonna do, I have to look at the menu, but we're gonna be doing a little ragu with the morels. We'll actually be sauteing some of these too with some of the ramps that we have left that we dehydrated as a little powder, and then this is for three separate menus for the week, so we're doing different things with all of them, but a lot of it will get prepped out today. And then a lot of this, you know, like the stems on these beautiful shiitakes and oyster mushrooms will be, normally that's not edible because of the consistency of it, but we'll dehydrate those, grind them into a powder, and then we use that for pasta, making mushroom pasta.
When did foraging enter your menus, your cooking?
You know, it's been there all along because, you know, I grew up on a farm myself. So going out and, you know, with grandma and, you know, I remember it was the puffballs early on and the wild rhubarb and berries and beans growing all over the farm that I grew up on. And then, you know, when you're in the kitchen, you understand what those good ingredients are because you've been working with them for a long time, but they're not necessarily accessible at your fingertips as quick as you'd like them to be. And that's where he comes in to play.
Joswick works with foragers around the U.S. to make sure customers like David Magnasco have what they want when they want it. His most prized team is called Shroom Team 6. You probably have guessed Joswick is one of the six, along with his uncle and a few cousins. Joswick says they've been foraging together forever. Soon they'll be heading out for days at a time.
We'll be getting the refrigerated trailer, up and going, and we'll be rocking that going south for smooth chanterelles and a couple other different species, and then we're going to be going north to the Canadian border for black trumpets, hedgehogs, lobster mushrooms, stuff like that.
It's a time he cherishes, but Joswick says it's not all that glamorous.
100 degree temperatures most of the time with the heat index. We've created almost body suits basically of battery operated fans to be able to take the bugs and take the heat and be out there as long as possible, carrying usually 50 to 60 pounds on your back all day long.
He's not suggesting the average forager goes to such extremes. For Joswick, it's a passion and business. His advice for somebody who'd like to gently enter the world of foraging?
If you don't know it, don't eat it. That's probably the most basic line, but some of the species that I see people selling, other foragers selling, and like it took me almost 5 years before I could bring myself to sell some wild forage species because I did spore tests, I did third-party analysis, third-party identification, cross-referencing, because there's no way in heck I'm putting my name and my business's reputation on a mushroom that I even have 1% doubt on. In terms of just consuming, there's a handful of easily identifiable forage mushrooms that anyone who goes out there and grabs a book can go picking out within the year. There's a lot of cool stuff out there to eat, and it's just a matter of spending the time in the woods and getting to learn something new.
For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Lake Effect Susan Bentz introduced us to Michael Joswick as part of our summer-long agricultural series, Full Plate. You can find other stories and suggest some ideas for what we can cover at WUWM.com.
A short break now, and then a preview of the first festival on the summer calendar in Milwaukee, this weekend's Pride Fest. Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Here in Milwaukee, the true start of summer begins when the gates of the Henry Meyer Summerfest grounds open. And for the past 30 years, the festival that kicks off the season has been Pride Fest.
This year, Pride Fest will host many national and local performers over the course of the weekend while celebrating its 30th anniversary. But it will also honor many community leaders and programs that help in continuing the city's tradition of LGBTQ+ Pride.
Jorna Taylor of the Milwaukee Pride Board of Directors and local historian, author, and board vice president Michael Takash joined Audrey Nowakowski in the studio to talk not just about this year's celebration, but to take a look back at the first Pride Fest in 1987.
Taylor starts by explaining what will make this year's celebration special.
30 years, and man, this is going to mark my 21st year. Oh, I've just dated myself a little here of going to Pride Fest. Look, we once again are going to kick off summer right here in Milwaukee, and we are the festival that kicks off the season of festivals in Wisconsin. We're so lucky to be down at the Summerfest grounds, the only Pride Fest in the country that has its own dedicated grounds like this. And we have, once again, our star-studded entertainment lineup with the likes of Betty Who, one of my personal favorites, 10,000 Maniacs, Todrick Hall. We've got a number of different stages and all of the things you come to expect from a really great Pride Fest.
Now, did you have to make any extra efforts to get these extra big headliners to celebrate the anniversary? Was there a little nudge to them in the proposition? Be like, hey, this is, you know, our big year.
Well, I don't know if Michael would disagree with me, but it certainly doesn't hurt to be at, you know, I don't know, and he can talk about the history of Pride Fests in general, but I can't imagine that it hurts in a place like Wisconsin to be celebrating 30 years and the PR that would come with that if you're a big entertainment act.
Right. You guys also have a good tradition of celebrating the community on the first day in the opening ceremonies. So who's your keynote speaker this year?
Oh, I'm so excited. So we are kicking off opening ceremonies under what we call our dance pavilion. For those folks who don't know, that's the Johnson Control stage right inside the main gates. And we start at 3:00 and we'll have free admission again for folks to get in until 4:30. But we are so lucky that this year we are going to hear from Jim Obergefell. For folks who don't know who he was the lead plaintiff in the groundbreaking Supreme Court case, which ended up granting same-sex marriage across the United States. So I've heard he's incredibly dynamic, and I am so excited to hear from him.
And does that really, you know, raise Pride Fest's profile, too, to have someone like him come and speak and...
It absolutely does. One exciting note that people may remember is 2 years ago, it was only minutes before our opening ceremonies that marriage equality arrived in Wisconsin with the Justice Barbara Crabb case. It's really exciting that 2 years later, we're able to bring a trailblazer to Pride Fest Milwaukee to stand on the same stage that we celebrated the arrival of marriage equality in Wisconsin with the hero of the national case.
And also, you have a tradition of having a beneficiary for Pride Fest, and it's G-Safe this year. So why did you select this organization, and what does it do for Milwaukee?
So G-Safe is the state's leading advocate for LGBT students in public schools, and they lead the Gay-Straight Alliances, which have traditionally been in high school environments but have now started forming in middle schools as well. And given the political climate and given the recent surveys that have come out as recently as yesterday showing that as many as 70% of high school students have witnessed bullying in the past 30 days and 25% of LGBT students have been bullied in the past week, we felt that we needed to take a stand for Wisconsin's LGBT students and youth because our next generation of leadership comes from that talent pool. And if it is not protected and if it is not cultivated, and if those youth do not feel confident and secure enough to be their best selves, they may never be those leaders. So we are asking our patrons to consider taking a stand for LGBT youth as well at Pride Fest Milwaukee.
Well, and on that note, do you find that the patrons that come to Pride Fest year after year are inherently more altruistic and really do understand the importance of carrying on this history and not taking it for granted that this is the 30-year anniversary?
I would say that Pride Fest is viewed maybe a little differently than some of the other festivals in that we are a really dedicated community festival that makes a stand to give back through these sorts of things. And I really do believe that our attendees think that it is a great cause to be able to say, hey, yeah, I'd like to add $1 or $5 to this wonderful organization, and it's a different one every year. And hopefully with the 30th anniversary, they'll be even more generous.
Now, let's transport back to 1987, which was the very first inaugural Pride Fest. So why don't you set the scene for us, Michael? What was it like? I imagine it's a big difference compared to what we know today.
Certainly. So the national political landscape was very different in 1987, and it was very volatile. The act of having gay pride was not just going to a party or a festival or, you know, enjoying your weekend at a dance pavilion. It was really an act of political statement, and it was an act of defiance. The AIDS epidemic had really ravaged the United States. The LGBT community did not have support from healthcare leaders, from political leaders. In many cases, they felt that they were invisible. So the act of taking pride in your community really was making a stand and, you know, marching or rallying. It wasn't going to a parade and having fun. It was really more of an active statement. In fall of 1987, the second March on Washington for LGBT rights took place, and that really mobilized a lot of the organizations nationwide to take shape, many here in Wisconsin, many on a national level. And it was out of that, I guess, pressure cooker that the Milwaukee Lesbian Gay Pride Committee formed later in 1987. The first actual Pride Fest was not until September 10th, 1988, but that picnic, as it was very small in comparison to what we see today with 35,000 people attending a three-day weekend festival. The picnic was in Mitchell Park. It had sports activities, it had food activities, and it had more of a community get-together potluck feel, and it was just an afternoon. So when you think about that, 30 consecutive summers later, to be welcoming national and even international talent, to have over 150 acts on 8 stages, to welcome national political leaders, local government officials, and really be able to be celebrated on a national scale is really commendable. I mean, we receive media attention in The Advocate and other national publications every year for the spectacle that we put on.
You mentioned that it wasn't a welcome thing or an easy thing to do to be able to have a pride celebration in that time. So with that first picnic and then growing to the Pride Fest the next year, do you find that there was the same group of people who really went the extra mile, took the extra effort to be able to organize and establish something in a time where, compared to having unofficial pride gatherings like, say, in 1973 with the Gay People's Union out of UW-Milwaukee, there was some small events, but to really establish something, what kind of obstacles did they face?
Well, they're the same obstacles, truly, that we face today. PrideFest is 100% volunteer-owned and operated, so we do not have any paid staff. This is no one's full-time job. Although people are working on it full-time year-round and certainly this week and even, you know, double time and a half this weekend, yes. This has never been someone's full-time job. And the point of the matter is it's much easier to do this work today with the support of the community and sponsors and donors and a massive pool of volunteers than it was 30 years ago. The people who really pulled this together in the late 80s really have to be commended, because not only were they under tremendous social pressure not to exist, but they did not have the sponsors, donors, volunteers, and entertainment that we have today. There was no Pride Festival circuit to draw talent from. There were no resources available. There was no internet. I mean, it was really a crazy time. Two of the leaders who were very instrumental in the forming of what is now Pride Fest actually passed away this year, and Sheldon Schur and Rick Finger really cannot be applauded enough for the work that they did in the earliest years of Pride Fest with their colleagues to make this happen. We wouldn't be having a Pride Fest if it wasn't for their contributions.
Many people may think of Milwaukee as another Midwest town. We have a slight inferiority complex to Chicago, you know, things like that.
Oh, you're just saying that.
Right. But, you know, a lot of people who you can ask, like, what city do they associate Pride with, or being known for something such as like New York or San Francisco as a city is known by the average person. But what do we have here that equally amounts to those cities in Milwaukee?
That's a good question. I think the strength of Milwaukee's LGBTQ and allied community is that we are close-knit and that we support each other. There is a huge community that makes sure that we are visiting LGBT-owned businesses or welcoming and inclusive businesses. There is a really great spirit among the other festivals that we share, not only with Pride Fest, but with the other ethnic festivals and things. And I think that Milwaukee has put itself on the map not only as an LGBTQ-friendly area, but also as a place where you can raise a family in a more equal and just society that offers a quality of life that is maybe it offers the same things as a large city, but a little bit less fast-paced in some ways. You know, I love living here, and I'm so glad to be a part of this thriving and growing community.
And I do have to say that when we show people, whether it's in New York during their Pride Parade weekend or in Chicago during IML weekend, when we're on the road marketing Pride Fest around the Midwest or even around the country, no one can believe the photos. They can't believe that these events are happening here. I have friends that travel in from the coasts every year for Pride Fest because it is better in their perception than their local Pride festivals. We're able to provide a very safe and secure festival mm-hmm. because of the fact that we are on a protected grounds that are closed to the public unless you've paid for admission and gone through security screenings. So unlike street fairs in other cities, parade routes in other cities, neighborhood festivals, picnics in the park even, we have such layers of security that ensure a safe, meaningful, and memorable event.
Right. That's a good thing to bring up because we know it as it kicking off the summer and a great thing to start the season, but many still would contest its existence today. And there's usually always protesters across the street from the main entrance and counter-protesters, you know, across the street to welcome people in regardless. And, you know, in its 30-year history, has there been any major issues or were these precautions to keep the safety level great just kept the same?
We over the years have changed with the times. So certainly when the picnic in the park was happening in Mitchell Park, Juneau Park, Veterans Park, it was a different world 20 years ago. It was a different time. And I think we were all a little bit more innocent. As the world has changed and as our patrons have, you know, expected and rightfully so, a environment that, you know, can guarantee their safety, we've layered on the same precautions as every other summer festival, including Summerfest, to ensure that nobody has anything to worry about. They can focus on fun and not have to focus on safety. That's our job. We have three levels of security at Pride Fest, whether it is our own volunteer troops, the Milwaukee Police Department, and Summerfest security grounds. So between those three layers and all of the screenings and the front end, really it's nothing to worry about.
Yeah.
I will say that, you know, you asked if, you know, the world has changed and, you know, has Pride Fest changed with it? One thing that we sometimes are challenged with is that we've gone away from, you know, the resistance, away from the defiance, away from the original nature of Pride. I think that this year we have really focused our efforts on bringing in talent that goes back to that original spirit, bringing in speakers who really, you know, remind us why the battle for LGBT civil rights did not end with marriage equality. We've brought in performers who are very diverse, who reflect the full character of our community. And I think that this year is a very different Pride Fest. As we look forward to the future, you know, we need to start thinking in new and fresh ways about how we represent ourselves in the community. And I think our lineup does that well this year, both from a speaker perspective as well as an entertainer perspective. And one thing that I've always challenged Pride Fest goers to do is look beyond the headliners, because many times people will look at just the first three people on the list and not look at everything else. We have remarkable talent this year. We have the Milwaukee Record Stage, for example, has tremendous independent alternative talent that's making their Pride Fest debut at the first festival of the summer. And great bands, Tiger Knight, Fatty Acids, No-No, I mean, just really great talent. The women's spot is offering a tremendous lineup this year on two stages, so it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And even the Stonewall stage is offering, you know, meet and greets with Randy Rainbow. We're offering an information session with the FBI on hate crimes. There's a panel on LGBT civil rights with the ACLU. And then as well, we have an arts and culture stage that focuses specifically on Pride Fest's 30-year history, an Eldon Murray exhibit on one of the elders of our community, as well as our trans family, which is an art exhibit that's been traveling around the city. So there's a lot more to do at Pride Fest than just see the headliners.
It's more than just a party.
It is definitely more than a party. But the party is fun.
Definitely.
Right. I mean, when you add up all the hours, we're open for, we're open for 33 hours over the course of the weekend. And every hour of that weekend is packed with at least five things to do.
Yeah.
Now, Michael, you and I have talked about the history of gay bars in Milwaukee back with your book, LGBT Milwaukee. And I'm curious, has this scene of Milwaukee gay bars changed drastically over the years that Pride Fest has existed and has influenced how Pride Fest was organized or even adding to the level of attendance to gay bars either during or even after, because Pride Fest is only one weekend a year?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And many times we do hear the challenge of, you know, why doesn't Pride Fest work more closely with the bars, and why is Pride Fest not in the bar neighborhood? We don't really hear that as much since many of the bars that were in that neighborhood have closed over the past 10 years. I think that the important thing to remember is that, you know, whatever you choose to do Pride Fest weekend is your choice. And the fact that you have multiple choices, whether it's to go to the festival, go to the parade, go to the bars, there's so much going on in Milwaukee that weekend that I really don't think anyone could run out of things to do. And our goal as an organization is always to complement that, not to compete, because we are all within one community. And our ideal is that people can navigate all three aspects of the community that weekend and do whatever they want and maybe do multiple things and have, again, that very safe and meaningful experience. In terms of the gay bars influencing Pride Fest and vice versa, I think that, you know, around 10, 12 years ago, that might have been the case. And that is certainly one of the reasons why the parade is in Walker's Point rather than affiliated with Pride Fest and doesn't start or end at Pride Fest. But I don't know that it's the case anymore. I think that nowadays we are in a mutually beneficial relationship, all of us together, and the city as well.
Well, I'm sure it'll be a great success worthy of a 30-year celebration. So, Michael and Jorna, I want to thank you guys for coming in today.
Well, thanks so much for having us again. We appreciate it.
Yes, thank you.
Jorna Taylor of the Milwaukee Pride Board of Directors and local historian, author, and board vice president Michael Takash joined Audrey Nowakowski in the studio.
Pride Fest opens this afternoon and runs through Sunday at the Summerfest Festival Grounds. You can find more information and past Pride photos at WUWM.com.
World-famous pop artist Peter Max will be in Milwaukee this weekend. We'll hear a bit from him and talk with the owner of the gallery that's bringing him here when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Even if you do not know his name, you have probably seen the artwork of Peter Max. Max is one of the world's most famous living pop artists. His bright, bold color palette has been applied to depict everyone from rock stars to the Statue of Liberty.
This weekend, Max himself will be at Gallery 505 in Whitefish Bay to kick off an exhibition of his collected works. I caught up briefly with the 79-year-old Max by phone from his New York studio as he was preparing to come to Milwaukee, and he talked about his love of color.
Probably all developed over years and years, but I've always loved color and always painted with color, so I always enjoyed it. I always enjoy the whole adventure of color.
What is it about it that's an adventure for you?
There's suddenly so many beautiful color combinations that you can make, you know, colors that are combined and opposite colors, so many ways, and it's always very interesting.
If you don't mind, take me through a day for you that where you get to work in the studio. What is your process like?
You mean when I'm painting?
Yes.
Well, I have a palette that has about 50, 60 colors, and I've got many brushes, and I just start picking the colors as I like them. It's very natural for me now.
And when you come to these events, like the one you're going to be here in Milwaukee, what kinds of things do you get from talking to your audience, for people who love your work and want to interact with you?
It's very nice. It's very personal in most cases, and I love it. I love talking to them. And it's all about my adventures and what I do in art and how they see it and how I see it, and it's all relative. It's very nice.
When you come to someplace like Milwaukee, are you hoping to sell work, or are you more interested in interacting with your audience?
I just like come. It's always a very interesting phenomenon. You know, I come to the gallery. It's nice for me. You know, we sell work. I meet the people. It's just an ongoing, very nice place all the time.
Is it a surprise to you that you have become an industry? You're Peter Max, the artist, but there's like Peter Max, the industry, too.
I know it surprised me for many years. You know, I'm kind of used to it now, but it's very interesting, isn't it?
Pop artist Peter Max speaking from his New York studio as he prepared to come to Wisconsin for the opening of an exhibit of his collected works at Gallery 505 in Whitefish Bay.
Well, Tom Harris is the owner of Gallery 505, and he tells Lake Effect's Eden Herbert why he was so interested in bringing this Peter Max show to his gallery.
I mean, since I was a young boy, I have followed Peter's work, and I know that Peter has been a relevant artist for the last 50 years, and I know that Peter is also getting older, and I wanted to make sure that these shows are seen by as many people as possible, because I do worry that they're not going to be around much longer, because the art world has changed so much that I called and talked with the owner of the Roadshow and begged him to come to Milwaukee. I was a little afraid they wouldn't want to come because our art market is large, but we have a very emerging and developing art market that I think gets stronger and stronger by the day. And I know the people in Milwaukee and Wisconsin and will help support the arts and our endeavors to always move it forward.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you had to use any superpowers to get somebody like Peter Max to come to Milwaukee.
For the most part, a lot of harassing seemed to do pretty well.
Okay.
And I called them on a regular basis and begged and pleaded and really pushed hard to make sure that they would come to Milwaukee. And that's really what I had to do, because this isn't, as big of an art market. And so we did have to really push hard to get a show like this to come here.
Do you think there's something about your specific gallery that lends itself well to showcasing work like Peter Max?
Well, I do think I have a large, we have a pretty large space here, and the artists that I sell on a day-to-day basis lean towards Peter's colors. And I do think as they were checking out my webpage and things like that they could see that I have clients that purchase in the right prices that probably made it a little more attractive for some of that. And I told them I'd work hard, and I knew my staff would work hard. And we would do whatever we could to make sure that we can continue to bring quality art shows to Milwaukee.
So he's a huge pop artist. That's the category that he would put himself in.
Correct.
Does your gallery often have pop art? Like you mentioned that his colors play well with the art that you already have there.
I can't say that I have artists that are pop artists, mm-hmm. but I deal with all living artists that are currently painting pieces that would use very colorful and bright colors, because that's really what I'm attracted. I am attracted to fun, hip artwork, and I love texture and bright colors, and everything what Peter Max does are really pieces that I like. I love the backstories behind why Peter paints and why he has gotten involved with certain things and certain organizations. And for me, it's people who live it, breathe it, and feel it, and that's really why I chose to really work to get Peter to come here. The fact that he was willing to come here, that is just such a bonus. I would have just taken the art show, but him coming here is just so fantastic.
As you mentioned, you work with all living artists, and often there's a stigma that comes with art that it's probably an artist won't be successful until after they've passed. But somebody like Peter Max, who's putting out pop art, I was wondering if you think there's something about being a pop artist that makes it possible to be successful while still alive.
Well, I would even take that a step farther to say I don't think it matters necessarily the genre that you're in that produces somebody relevant in today's market or one artist. It's people who really capture, you know, art is fickle, and it all depends on who's painting. Peter is just very well, I would say that people really have followed him for so many years, and he's been involved with big projects. I mean, from Super Bowls to the Olympics to the restoration of the Statue of Liberty. When you have somebody who's been involved and is so caring about the environment and other things, I think that also plays into why his art gets what it gets. Why this one artist, you know? It's hard for me to answer that question 100% because I have come across thousands of fabulous artists that maybe never get to the next level. And I can't tell you why. You know, even for me today, I look at some of the artists that I carry. Why is one selling better than another? And then that changes from month to month. It's the amount of people that have responded to Peter's pieces, and I do think the fun of his work and the involvement that he has been over the last 50 years is what's kept him so relevant, that he also has sought and has sought different avenues that he could sell his art and make it accessible for the average person. You know, some of his art's pretty expensive, but he has price ranges from $2,500 and up.
And he's actually going to be selling some of his art this weekend, correct?
Correct. All these pieces that we have in our show are for sale.
And what do you think the likelihood of a market like Milwaukee getting people to actually buy art like this is?
We are already having very successful pre-sales, and that has proven that he is still a relevant artist in today's market, because we are selling pieces. And I could tell you that from my gallery's point, for some of the pieces that we've typically sold in our prices, some of his are much more expensive than anything I've typically sold, and we are having good luck with his art, because I just think in today's world, people value Peter's work and know that he's not going to be painting forever, and I think that's what also has helped with some of his sales. And, you know, a lot of it is up to the artist and how much they want to paint. And I hope that gallery owners have the same feelings I do, that we're really promoters of the arts and we get involved with the arts. And it's really a working relationship with the artist / gallery owner. You know, I know a lot of artists go direct to the public and they don't use galleries, but galleries have a great way, and we generally have good relationships with a lot of the art community that we're able to introduce things that they wouldn't often get to see without us.
Transitioning back to Peter Max a little bit, we think about how we're at a time where people can kind of be their own pop artist with filters people can put on social media, especially apps like Snapchat. What do you think it is about Peter Max that continues to establish his own work as original or unique?
Well, because printing itself is changing so much, but what Peter does is he's still painting. There's something to be said about an artist that is painting their pieces and using brush strokes, and he's an acrylic painter, and to still have that capability of just painting. It's one thing to have a vision of what a picture should look like, where you can manipulate a computer or a screen to put things on, but it's a whole nother to be able to paint and have that ability to cross the differences in mixed media, to interchange that and still be able to use a brush. And I think Peter captures certain icons that are still very uplifting for the American people, or I mean for the international market, that people just connect with, and they see it and they just fall in love with it. But he's kept his artwork, you know, for so many decades. He reproduces a lot of images that he is in love with. And I think that's what comes through on a lot of the canvases in the paper. It is just his love of the arts that is just so happy and fun and carefree that's what you gather with his art.
So you mentioned this a little bit earlier about how he's actually been the official artist for 5 Super Bowls, the 2006 Olympics, the World Series, the Kentucky Derby, and even the Indy 500. What do you think it is about the worlds of sports and the world of art that seems to allow this kind of easy overlap between the two?
Yeah. I think his movement and his paintings and the way he captures movement, I would say that probably is part of it. You know, I don't know what his love of the sports is, but I know he's also willing to paint on different substrates. I mean, I've seen him paint on balls and bats and his love of music. And I think that's what there's certain of that I can't answer, that I don't know why the sporting industry, you know, I think back to when I originally saw the soccer prints for the Olympics and some of the sporting things that he's done. And to me, it would be the way that he captured the movements in a lot of his pieces.
Tom Harris, thank you so much for joining us on Lake Effect, and we look forward to joining you this weekend at the gallery.
Well, fantastic. And we really hope that as many people can come on by and really experience the show, because that's really what it's all about. It's that we're hoping that people can really experience what his art is and how relevant it has been over the last 50 years.
Right, and to be able to do it while he's there with us is so special. So thank you so much again for taking the time to speak with us while you're getting ready for this big deal.
You're welcome.
Tom Harris owns Gallery 505 in Whitefish Bay. He spoke with Lake Effect's Eden Herbert. Peter Max will be at Gallery 505 on Saturday evening and Sunday afternoon. It is free, but reservations are required. You can find a link to more information at WUWM.com.
From popular art to a popular summertime frozen dessert treat. What could that be? Bubbler Talk makes a temporary return from its summer vacation when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Lake Effect Mitch Tyke. Bubbler Talk is supposed to be on its summer break as we gather more questions and look for more answers to what you've always wanted to know about this place we call home. But not long before the hiatus, a question came in that would be a shame to wait until fall to answer.
Hi, my name is Sarah Rishu. I'm calling in from San Francisco. My question is, why is frozen custard such a big deal in Milwaukee?
We don't typically get a lot of questions from San Francisco, but as you might expect, there is a reason Sarah got in touch. She is a Milwaukee area native with a frozen custard history.
Well, it was my summer job. I worked there for 5 years as a teenager at both Hefner's and Out and Out in Cedarburg.
And do I gather at one point you had a boyfriend who also worked in frozen custard?
That's correct. At Lick's, it used to be on Downer and Bellevue, and now that's the location of Pizza Man.
To figure out the answer to Sarah's question, we tracked down Bobby Tanzillo, co-author of the seminal book on the subject called Milwaukee Frozen Custard. Actually, he was pretty easy to track down because he is also managing editor at On Milwaukee, whose offices are across the street from the WUWM studios in downtown Milwaukee. Anyway, we asked him that very basic question. Why is frozen custard such a big deal here versus anywhere else?
I don't think anybody really knows why. I mean, we talk to all kinds of people. We talk to custard stand owners. We talk to the dairies that make custard mix. All these people who should theoretically know.
Right.
And everybody has some sort of theory. Maybe, but...
I mean, we are a dairy state.
Right, we're a dairy state, which seems obvious, you know, in one way. But I think what we got from talking to all these people in the Venn diagram, that overlapping section, was that in Milwaukee, there's always been this, among the custard stand operators, has been a commitment to quality first, you know, and then as part of that, cooperation. Do you know what I mean? And what happens is, you know, Joe Clark is the guy who opens the first custard stand here. And he hires a guy named Paul Gillis, who then goes and opens Gillies. And then he has a night manager named Leon Schneider, who then goes and opens Leon's. You know, I mean, and then, you know, Art Richter has the Milky Way and he needs somebody to manage the Milky Way. He hires Elsa Kopp, who then opens her own place. You know, and while this is going on, Leon is helping all these other people at the same time. You know, and Leon's, you know, trained Al, who opens Al's, you know, Trudy, who opens Trudy's. And, you know, they were never really in competition with other custard stands. They wanted other custard stands to serve a quality product because they wanted people to associate custard with being a quality product. So when he would say, you know, somebody would drive past here and see that we sell custard, and if they've had custard in the past and it's good, they'll stop and have custard. If they've had custard in the past somewhere else and it's bad, they'll just keep driving.
So the guy who spent months trying to track down the answer of why frozen custard is such a big deal in Milwaukee says the answer is no one really knows. Unlike frozen custard itself, that is kind of unsatisfying. But as Bobby Tanzillo says, there are a lot of things that make the custard scene special, like the cooperation between the big three, Kopp's and Gillis and Leon's. But maybe another important question to ask is, what makes frozen custard special, or at least distinct, from other frozen dairy desserts? We found someone to help us.
My name is Bill Klein, and I am the plant manager for the Babcock Hall Dairy Plant, which is on campus here at University of Wisconsin, Madison.
Klein offered a definition.
In order to be called a custard, you need to have 1.4% egg yolk solids. So it's got to have that. But beyond that, it has to meet the definition of ice cream, which is, 10%, at least 10%. Milk fat, no more than 100% overrun, and 20% total solids. So if you compare it to ice cream, it's the only difference is it's got, you know, that egg yolk added to it. And the egg yolk is added for both flavor as well as an emulsifier.
In case you aren't familiar with a couple of those terms, overrun is the amount of air whipped into a dairy dessert, and an emulsifier is something that allows two ingredients to mix together. But Klein says when it comes to the soft custard you get on a summer evening in Wisconsin, there is another key factor in play.
It's more than just ice cream. It's right off the machine, so it's served warm as opposed to where 5 degrees is what normally you find dipped ice cream at. Soft serve is generally about 20 degrees.
And that turns out to be one of the important elements in Milwaukee's frozen custard culture, seeing the custard come right out of the machine. In an era in which so much manufacturing is automated, frozen custard makers say a large part of the appeal for customers is in seeing the employees pouring the mix into the top of the gleaming steel machines and seeing the river of custard come out the front. Ron Schneider owns Leon's, the shop his dad founded on Milwaukee's South Side in 1942. He says it would be possible to automate the process, but
I think that would be a negative thing to not have employees for us, because frozen custard originated on Coney Island. It was a carnival treat. And when you go to a carnival or the state fair, especially if there's a midway, much of the attraction is what's going on. You go to the saltwater taffy booth, and they have the machine there pulling the taffy. And when that thing's pulling taffy, there's a crowd. As soon as they turn it off, take the taffy off, everybody walks away. Years ago, my father sold a frozen custard machine to a man in town here. And the man put it in his tobacco store, of all places. And while he was waiting for the machine to be built, he came here and observed everything and noticed that we seemed to sell more product when the machine was running than when it wasn't. So when he got the machine, he put it in his store right in the front window, Everybody who came in could see it. Everybody who walked by could see it. He made enough money the first year to completely pay for the machine. And he also refurbished and remodeled his tobacco store. This is on the proceeds of running frozen custard out of one machine. The second year, he put the machine in the back room. The third year, my father bought it back from him.
It's the same at Cops. Dan McGuire is the second in command at the Cops on Blue Mound Road in Brookfield.
People, when they come in here and they see the machines running, it's total fascination. And yeah, it's a great, great product when it's fresh.
These machines, three of them out there, are actually, I would guess, to be over 70 years old.
That second voice was Dick Mac McGuire, Dan's dad. He managed the original Cops stand at 60th and Appleton, which Elsa Cop's son, Carl, sold to him in the 1970s. He moved it to Brookfield in 1991. Mac McGuire says there is a lot that's special about frozen custard here. The taste, the gleaming machines, the flavor of the day idea the Cops pioneered. But he believes it all comes back to the relationship between the people in the business.
It's almost like a brotherhood also, because this is the hotbed for frozen custard. And when you have only so many few places that make it, you know, we know who each other are. Ron Schneider has been a friend for a long time. He supplies us with custard machine parts. His dad helped Mrs. Kopp get in business. So we have a friendly relationship with the other people in the business.
But maybe there is something even simpler at work. Tom Linscott owns the place that everyone calls Gillies, but is really called Gillis. It is the oldest frozen custard stand in Milwaukee at 75th and Blue Mound. Linscott remembers a lesson he learned from a consultant with whom he worked years ago.
He said, "Hey, you have no idea what you have here." He goes, "People make it a point to stop by you and part with their resources." He goes, "You're not selling tires. You're not selling car service where it's like, I don't want to spend the money on this." He goes, "You're not going to the dentist where people have phobias." He goes, "They are selectively choosing to go there." And I'm like, you know what? Another simple thought process that I should be grateful for on a more daily basis, you know?
So, Sarah Rishu, that is what makes frozen custard in Milwaukee special. The real question is, can you get custard where you live in the Bay Area?
You know, surprisingly, we can. We had some food trucks down at our Civic Center station when I first moved here. I was so excited.
And how does Bay Area frozen custard stack up against what you remember back here?
You know, it's not the same.
Bubbler Talk is a production of WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio and made possible by The Board Game Barrister, satisfying Milwaukee's thirst for fun with games, classic toys, and puzzles for all ages. Locations at Bayshore, Greenfield, South Milwaukee, and now Mayfair. Do you have a question about Milwaukee you want answered? Submit it to us at WUWM.com, and maybe we'll quench your thirst for knowledge.
You'll find a link to the feature on Milwaukee's frozen custard in this month's Milwaukee Magazine, plus see pictures and submit your own Bubbler Talk questions at WUWM.com. And that is all for Friday's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Bonnie and I produce the show along with Audrey Nowakowski and Joy Powers, plus the production assistants of Mayan Silver and our spectacular interns, Katie Kokel and Eden Herbert.
We get additional reporting from Susan Bentz and Rachel Morello, plus web support from Michelle Maternowski and studio engineering from John Strelecki. Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll join us tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It is 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.